Joe Newman and a bunch of his friends, who also happened to be jazz greats, with Wednesday's Blues. Joe Newman, as I said, is starting out on trumpet, Frank West on tenor sax, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Eddie Jones on bass, and Oliver Jackson on drums. This is from Newman's 1960 album, Wednesday's Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we're going nuclear. We're exercising the nuclear option today on the program. What is that? What does that mean? Well, investigative reporter, author, teacher, and activist Paul D'Arienzo is with us today. You may recall that he did a startling series on nuclear matters generally across the United States, but one place in particular, the most contaminated site in the United States, the Hanford site in Washington State. So he's talking today. He's going to tell the story. We are all just going to listen, because when we started talking, Paul and I had no clue about what it is he was talking about. And it compelled me to just shut up and listen. Listen to what it is he's saying. And what he's about to tell us today is about highly elevated levels of radiation and contamination that have been found in the city of New York. And nobody knows why or how these areas became contaminated. I'm sure they do know, but they're not telling us. So he is here to file his newest report focusing on nuclear contamination in New York City, which, as he will tell us, is the epicenter of radiation-producing industries at one time, many, many decades ago. But a 2005 control sampling found elevated levels of radiation in as many as 80 spots. When you say spots, but areas, 80 areas across the city, including a national park that was ordered closed and still has not reopened. Where is this radiation coming from? Do New Yorkers even know this? Is New York the only place that is experiencing this? We don't know. So he's here to unfold the truth, because it's an ongoing project. This is his latest project. And as it goes, he will apprise us of what it is he's finding out. Paul D'Arienzo and I were colleagues at WBAI, and we ended up being colleagues here at PRN.FM. He is to be heard on Sundays at 1 on his own program, The Torch. But he brings serious credentials to this endeavor of his, which is always trying to find out what the truth is about things. He's a teacher, a father, he's an activist. He's been working under a grant from the George Polk Awards, studying the effects of nuclear weapons production on the environment. He used to host a program on WBAI called Let 'Em Talk, and went to the local Manhattan Neighborhood Network with that program as well. And he writes as well. Not only does he appear on these programs, but he writes for other programs, including This Can't Be Happening, Who, What, Why, and Counterpunch, and he's a regular contributor to The Villager, New York City's oldest community newspaper. He is doing this now after having set precedents, I think, with his book, The Ibogaine Story, and he's researching this book, another book coming up soon, I hope, on the history of slavery in New York City. And I am delighted to call him my friend. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Great to be on the show with you, you trees, and we definitely are very close friends and have been. We've been through a lot together.
We've been through a lot together.
We're seriously bonded.
So yes, we are. Now, let's start with what it is. Could you set up what it is you're going to talk about with us today?
Sure. Well, we're waiting for the final report on what's called the Operational Unit 1 of the Great Kills Park unit of the National Park Service's Gateway National Park in Staten Island along the Atlantic coast, a little bit south of where you cross over the Verrazano Bridge. And the reason we're waiting on this report, and it's, as you said earlier, 2005 was when the flyover happened. And it's interesting to note that it was from the time of the flyover to the time the public was informed that the park was radioactive was 14 months. There was no, talking about secrecy, the fact that the park was dangerously radioactive was kept from the public for 14 months. And the affected areas, although it was 2005 when it was discovered, the affected areas in the park were not closed until 2009. So for 5 years, there was no fencing or no signs or nothing to keep people out. And interestingly enough, around the same time, at first didn't seem connected, but now I wonder, the New York Police Department, NYPD, approached the city council and asked them to ban private ownership of Geiger counters. And this law would have passed. I mean, they just came up to ask the city council. City council was just to perform a do it. And fortunately, it turns out a lot of hobbyists own Geiger counters, and a committee of angry hobbyists descended on the city council, and the city council backed down. Why is
now,
it that
Geiger counters, I just want to interject, Geiger counters measure the levels of radiation.
Right. See, it's very hard to measure. Radiation is, you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't smell it, you can't feel it, you can't, you know, it's totally invisible to humans. And so there's no way of knowing. And even finding radiation, even with modern technology, is difficult. And many, many attempts were made over the years to develop devices that could count radiation. The Geiger counter is one of them, and it goes back to the 50s, and you might have seen the old movies where the old prospector's going up in the mountains and looking for his uranium with his Geiger counter. You hear that tick, 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 and that tells you you're picking up gamma radiation or alpha radiation or beta radiation, depending on the type of Geiger counter you have. That's a little different from the film badge, or now they call them dosimeters, and a dosimeter is worn on your shirt, and it beeps whenever there's radiation around, so you can know if you're immediately getting a dose. Before that, they used film badges, and that's how radiation was discovered. There's a film, and you would actually develop the film badge and then find out afterwards if somebody had been dosed with radiation. Fortunately, we've moved past the film badge level, although I hear they still do use them. So the reason radiation was first discovered by a man named Becquerel in the 1890s, who put some uranium ore he was experimenting with, not knowing any of its properties really, in a drawer on top of a wrapped package full of film that he was using for another purpose. And then he later on developed the film and saw blotches on the film where the rock had been sitting on the package. And that was very disconcerting, because if you know the history of science, for hundreds of years, scientists trying to convince humanity that there are no ghosts and no secret, you know, no invisible spectral energies out there that determine humanity, that in fact there are scientific laws and principles. So when they discovered radiation causing something to happen at a distance away from the actual source of the radiation, nobody wanted to get involved in it because it was like ghost stuff or magic stuff. And nobody wanted to touch it. And with a 10-foot pole, and there was very little research done at first until a brilliant young woman from Poland named Marie Curie, who was a genius in a country where women were not allowed to go to college and had to go to a secret hidden school in Warsaw before she finally left for Paris, where she became a professor at the Sorbonne, professor of physics. And she had decided, because she was like the only woman in the business at the time, she took the job that no man wanted. Like, they wouldn't let, like, all the men in her doctoral, in the world of physics, in that doctoral world, chemistry and physics, they took all the plum research jobs, the ones that would lead to Nobel Prizes and fame and fortune and all those kind of things. And they left the woman with what was then considered the garbage, which was radiation. And nobody wanted to touch radiation because of its implications of something operate like a ghost operating at a distance seemed to go against everything that they've been trying to tell people wasn't true for hundreds of years. So nobody wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole, which I think is an interesting attitude for the scientists. So she began to study radiation. And what she did was she took an element called an ore called pitchblende from a place we now know is the Czech Republic. And she began basically boiling it. Her and her husband, Pierre, boiled it down in a huge vat. And they boiled it down, tons of it. And it turns out 1 ton of uranium ore produces 1/10 of a gram of radium. Radium is produced naturally by the decay of uranium. As uranium naturally decays, it produces many daughters or byproducts, and one of them is the element radium. It actually, radiation is what the alchemists tried to do centuries ago. You can change elements to other elements. Back then, they tried to make gold. Yeah, you can make gold in a nuclear reactor. You can make anything in a nuclear reactor, probably. And it's been discovered since then when people thought that alchemy was a joke. It actually was true. You could do it, but you couldn't have done it chemically. You have to do it in the nucleus of the atom atomically, and they didn't have the technology to do it until recently, until last century. And so basically, as she boiled down this pitch blend, removing the uranium from it, which was already long ago discovered, they discovered that the what was left was becoming more and more radioactive, which is shocking. And as they started to boil, and can you imagine, this took 2 years of boiling, of people just standing over pots of boiling stuff. And then they started to notice over time, after about a year of boiling and boiling the same stuff over and over again in acid, they would shut off the lights and the whole room would glow green. And they would look in their arms and hands and legs and clothes, and the room dripping down the walls would be glowing green. That had never, something like that had never been seen before in history. It was shocking to those people, that even to the smartest people, nobody had ever seen anything like it. And so as they boiled it down, first thing they discovered was polonium, which is another radioactive element. And Marie Curie named it after her home country, Poland. That was her first element, polonium. And then she kept boiling it down, which was a crucial element in nuclear weapons production, and later on, years later. And then she started boiling down it more and more, and she got to this element called radium. And radium is a fiercely radioactive element, a fiercely, fiercely radioactive element. And radium has sort of a problem because radium is, people love the fact that it attracted people's attention because it glowed in the dark. People just loved it. And they wanted it and wanted to be part of it. And so people, marketers started to sell things with radium in it to the public because they didn't think of it as death or poison. They thought of it as life, as giving energy, life. The life force of energy had been discovered. And so a market soon developed in quack medicines based on radium. But also there was concurrent with that, scientists like Howard A. Kelly 1858, 1943, founder of Johns Hopkins Hospital. He was the first, or among the first, to use radium in cancer treatment in 1904. And he would literally put radium to little tiny metal needles and sew them directly into the tumor. And that would kill the tumor, but sometimes, and so that amazed people that it killed the tumor, but it also sometimes would kill the patient. And so they were an experimental. They were, you know, this is all human experimentation, basically, at the time. And so as the only drug ever found, the only substance ever found that had any, in all thousands of years of human history, had any effect on cancer, at least noticeably to the scientific establishment, they began to produce radium needles, which were little needles filled with radium, and they were used at the early cancer hospitals all over New York City in the early 1900s. And so a company was developed to supply the radium. And at first, it was supplied from the western United States by a company headed by a name named Brothers, Joseph and James Flannery. And their mother had died of cancer, and they became obsessed with finding a cure. So they began to really get into the idea of manufacturing radium that was found in the United States. But it took 500 tons of American ore to make 1 gram of radium, and radium was worth $120,000 a gram in 1920s money. And so that caught on with that, and we can make money with this. So then you had the explosion of radium quackery, radium water, radium makeup. Women would put radium on their faces. They loved it. It looked beautiful. They would go out to parties and say they glowed in the dark and what have you. So Mr. Flannery, this is just the beginning of the horror story. So Mr. Flannery turned out to be the father-in-law of another man named Kelly. And Mr. Kelly, Kelly began to manufacture radium in large quantities and began to really supply this business. And the business was called the Standard Chemical Company, and that later became the Radium Chemical Company. And one thing they discovered was that radium, when mixed with certain chemicals, would glow, make those chemicals glow. This was different from the glow they saw on the wall. They actually just mixed a teeny bit of radium with a zinc sulfide, I think it's the chemical, and that will cause it to glow. And it makes a paint, and they created a paint. The paint was called Undark, right? And Undark was basically a radium paint to use to paint watches. This is a new development. Nobody had ever seen anything like this. This was like new to history. The idea of being able to paint the numbers on watch dials to make them glow in the dark. And it was not the first, it was immediately seen as something that was really important as far as the military use. Because Murphy's Law, if you're in a jet fighter or in those days a biplane fighter, and you are in a dogfight at night with an enemy, you could be assured that's exactly when the electrical connection to the lights on your instrument panel will go out. that is a religion in the military. You can never rely on anything too technical under the pressure of battle. It has to be simple. The things fail exactly when you need them. And so they would paint, they wanted to paint the dials inside the aircraft so that the fighter pilots could see them glow in the dark. Now, the West Clock Company in Connecticut also loved to make alarm clock. We know West Clock. Half of us probably have a West Clock in our house. They were the largest commercial consumer. So the government was consuming it, and the commercial establishment was consuming it, and a huge amount of this paint was created. And the company that Mr. Kelly eventually, he kept changing the names of his companies, but it eventually became called the U.S. Radium Corporation, right? So what they did was they set up factories in many places. The key ones are in Ottawa, Illinois, about an hour outside of Chicago, and in Newark, New Jersey. And they hired teenage girls. And they told the girls that they will pay them more than their fathers make. In these days of low salaries, they pay them more than any man could make. And they had skills of being able to paint fine numbers and things like that very quickly. And they became very expert at it. And one of the ways they became quick and expert at it was they taught them to lick the end of the brush in order to make it more pointy, and then dip it in the paint, and then use that to paint the numerals. Well, radium, if you look on the, and it's great to know, because with things like this, people often don't, get a copy of the periodic table of the elements. It's on the internet. It's free. You can buy one if you want to put it on your wall. Study it. Get to know it. It's one of the areas of science that everyone should know about. And because you want to know what you're dealing with. And the first step to understand what you're dealing with is to study the periodic table of elements and look at the families of related elements. If you look at the related elements next to radium, above and below radium, it is directly related to calcium. So that means that it tends to go exactly where the calcium goes. And calcium, of course, is the main constituent of our bones. So every time those women would lick those brushes and ingest the radium would immediately replace the calcium in their teeth and jaws and into their bodies and into their bones and get into their bones and irradiate the marrow inside their bones. The problem with radiation is that it's like a bullet. It's beta radiation is just an electron, like the electricity goes through your wire. Alpha radiation is basically a helium nucleus without the electrons around it. And gamma radiation is a photon of light, similar to light at very, very high energies. What sets these apart from just light or a regular electron or just a regular helium atom in your party balloon is that they have massive amounts of energy imparted to them because of the way they were born in a nuclear process. And, you know, talking about E equals MC squared. So that means that rather than like lazily bumping around in the environment or moving, you know, in a controlled fashion through a wire or just flashing from your flashlight, these forms of these of particles and photons are unbelievably energetic. And when they penetrate, the alpha bounces off your skin, but if you swallow it, it gets you from the inside. Electrons penetrate a little bit further. They're stopped usually by water or by even a thick layer of clothes would probably stop them. But again, if you expose your bare skin to them, you'll get a terrible burn long enough and more powerful enough. And then gamma radiation just goes right through you like an X-ray, boom. It's like a more powerful form of X-rays, which are bad enough. So what happens is that when these powerful particles and rays enter your body by either ingesting them inside of you or by passing through you if they're powerful enough, they can interact, go through your cells and interact with your DNA, and it's like somebody like bowling. Your DNA are like bowling pins, and these particles are like the bowling ball, and they go for a strike. And they can cause permanent damage to your DNA. Now, DNA has mechanisms for repairing itself, and that's why there's radiation always. Now, even in the most perfect world, there's a certain amount of like 10 or 12 millirads, I think it is, of background radiation all the time. So our bodies are somewhat used to some amount of radiation, and we do have natural mechanisms for protecting us against radiation when it's of a low level. Not to say that, but no radiation is considered safe. There's no such thing as safe radiation. The fact of the matter is we all eventually die, and even the background radiation we're prepared for contributes to to a certain degree to the living process, but eventually to the dying process. So, you know, radiation is just not good for you, any amount. By accident, even the lowest, least powerful amount of radiation can interact with a crucial part of your DNA by random bad luck and cause a problem. So, you know, you don't want to expose yourself to any radiation beyond what's absolutely the dire necessity. Now, scientists who are in the nuclear business and nuclear engineers, like to argue, and they make some argument that this, you know, we can't get too scared of this kind of thing. You can protect yourself against it. People, you know, radiation doesn't kill you right away or anything like that. It's, you know, unless it's in very, very high amounts, and there's very rare situations where you're like an atom bomb where you're exposed to huge amounts of radiation in one dose, only mostly workers and others. But, you know, there's plenty, as we'll get into in a little bit, there's plenty of high level radiation sources all over the place, radioactive materials all over the place. Unfortunately, we don't even know where all of them are, as we're going to find out in a minute. I'm not one of fear. I'm not a fear monger. I'm not telling you that you should get rid of radiation, although I've given this lecture to students at Pace University and other places where many of my students have said straight up, ban it. They don't care what good comes from it. Although it has been used to treat many illnesses, it has been used to treat cancer, and whatever people might say, there's people walking the street alive because of radiation. Now, the counteract is, if they hadn't discovered radiation, they might have found better, safer, less toxic ways to do the same thing, right? So, you know, maybe it is good to get rid of radiation. Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy, a very interesting guy in his own right. The guy is more responsible than anybody for nuclear power and nuclear power, submarines and ships and the nuclear navy, as well as nuclear power plants around the world. He always said, you know, he felt out of necessity to defend America against his enemies. I mean, I think that's a bit, you know, over the top, but that's what he believed and that's what people in the 50s believed. But he always said, why would you want to bring more? We have natural barriers in our atmosphere to prevent that radiation in outer space from hitting us on Earth. You know, only a small, small amount of radiation gets to us. And that small amount, like UV light in sunlight, which causes sunburns and skin cancer, are bad enough. Why would we want to bring more of this stuff on this side of the barrier that nature has spent billions of years creating to protect us so that life can thrive here on Earth? Why would we want to bring it on this side of the barrier? That's what Admiral Rickover himself said. So, you know, I'll leave it with that as far as the debate, the morality of using radiation for any purpose, whether health-giving or not. So,
assist a little bit in you telling us about the development and the way it happened. Where you just left off was the acclimation to radiation in what people would have considered just regular industries. How did it make the transition from, you know, the industrial to the military?
Well, what happened was that, and I have it here, I have a copy of the letter here. I read it to my students all the time. It's a letter dated August 2nd, 1939, from Albert Einstein, Old Grove Road, Nassau Point, Peconic, Long Island, to F.D. Roosevelt, President of the United States, White House, Washington, D.C. Sir, I won't read the whole thing. I'll get to the last paragraph. I understand that Germany has actually stopped the sale of uranium from the Czechoslovakian mines, which she has taken over. That she should have taken such early action might perhaps be understood on the ground that the son of the German Undersecretary of State, von Weizsäcker, is attached to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, where some of the American work on uranium is now being repeated. Yours very truly, Albert Einstein. All right, so when President Roosevelt received this letter on August 2nd, 1939, he turned it over to his science advisors, the ORSD, it was called, committee that had been set up to organize engineers and scientists for the war effort that was developing already. You know, the war hadn't started in the U.S. yet, but it was starting in Europe already. And the ORSD set a committee called the S1 Committee, which is headed by a man named Vannevar Bush, not related to the Bush family, but an old family in America. Lawrence Livermore, Lawrence from Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, Lawrence invented the cyclotron, which we'll learn about more later. And of course, James Conant, the chancellor of Harvard University, one of the oldest families in America, and tied into the top ruling class of America. And he was, I would say more than anybody, James Conant was the one who really talked to the president and said, this is real and you have to deal with this. They would go to Conant. You know, he was literally the biggest brain in America known as president of Harvard. And, and had a interesting family connection to all of this. A lot of this is happened at the level of the richest families in America, and some of them were very well educated and were already involved in doing research. And back in those days, before the government did research, rich people did like mad scientist stuff in these mansions, like up in Tuxedo Park, New York, and different places. And one of the reasons we find radiation all over New York was a tight connection between Avril Harriman and the Loomis family and the Rockefeller family in setting up nuclear industries in New York City and nuclear research in New York State. And they were at the very top, you know, the top ruling people. In fact, Standard Oil, the Rockefeller Oil Company, was the one that discovered the uranium that was in Staten Island. I'll get to it in a minute. So in August 2005, the New York Police Department with the Department of Energy conducted an anti-terrorism radiation flyover survey. The survey was intended to provide a baseline of radiological activity in order to catch a suspicious construction of a dirty bomb. They didn't find a dirty bomb, but there was plenty of radiological activity. Surveyors found 80 radioactive locations in the city, one of them being Great Kills Park in Staten Island, one of the city's five boroughs, a popular place near a suburban enclave inhabited by cops, firefighters, and other unsuspecting residents. The park, more than 500 acres of woods surrounding football and soccer fields and a marina, was constructed from garbage dumped in the bay between 1944 and 1946. Unregulated and illegal dumping has a long history in New York City. Actually, more information is coming out. We discovered that back then they had the garbage in New York City had been first eaten by pigs. They would throw it in the street and pigs would eat it. And what happened was by the 1860s and 70s, literally people were going up to their thighs in garbage. And filth was in all, especially in the poor neighborhoods and all the streets. The rich people could pay for their own private garbage pickup. And they would take this garbage, put it on barges, and float it out to the Atlantic Ocean and dump it. And it would of course wash up on the Jersey Shore beaches. And the state of New Jersey sued the city of New York. And after years and years of lawsuits in the early 20th century, finally in 1934, the Supreme Court ruled and banned all ocean dumping by New York City on behalf of New Jersey. So then, with no place to put their garbage, they started, and they had already been, if you go up in the Bronx, all along the waterfront of the Bronx, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Staten Island, has been since the days of the Dutch settlers, they've been using garbage to build landfill. And I would say maybe 20% of New York City is built on landfill, most of it garbage. And they have problems when Sandy came in. I was up at a friend of mine's a landowner in the Bronx. I've been writing about his site for my book on slavery in New York. And he showed me where there was a slave cemetery nearby, and I got to know the landowners. And he showed me where he got an old 1920s gun pistol washed up all rusty and everything, and he got all these other things like from the 20s and 10s and before that would wash up on the shore every time there was a big storm. And he found it fascinating, you know, because the whole waterfront was all garbage. The whole waterfront of New York City is built on garbage going back hundreds of years. But when they banned ocean dumping, it really was starting to get crazy. So what they did was they replaced it with what was Robert Moses, the commissioner of parks at the time and the master builder of New York and built all the roads and destroyed the South Bronx. And that's a whole story in itself. He loved incineration. But incinerators of that period and before were very, very, very inefficient. As a matter of fact, in the early incinerators in the 1800s, when they looked through the ash and the waste, and they actually were producing more waste than they were burning from the ash from the coal they were using to burn the garbage. And then they were also, a lot of stuff wouldn't, like 20-30% of the stuff wouldn't even be burned. And so it would just be buried in the ash. And so they had this incinerator ash stuff that went everywhere. All right. So, they had no place to put it. And so in New York City, there was, I believe, 82 or 86, something in the 80s, dumps. About 50 are known. More than 30 of them, nobody even knows where they are, were. And then there's all the places that they didn't even call dumps. I think Rikers Island is the biggest. And out there were Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn. That's another one. It's almost all garbage, all landfill. And it used to be the place where they had the glue factories, where they would take the dead horses and make them the glue. That's where the glue factory was. They call it Dead Horse Bay even today. Right? So they were taking all of this, according to the police and to the NPS and National Park Service and others, all this waste was Robert Moses wanted to build For years, he is behind this idea of building this waterfront park along Staten Island, and he was going to fill in this big wetland area. I mean, he hated swamps. He had this thing about what he considered swamps. He would be great for president, right? He could fill in the swamp, drain the swamp and fill it in. That's what he liked to do. And he really believed in draining swamps, building highways, and incineration. And, you know, they talk about New York, especially in the early 20th century. They started to get a little better by the 30s. But in the early 20th century, you would see, like, literally New York City was dominated by barges of garbage going in every different direction every day. And they had literally, it seemed like dozens, if not more, incinerators, mostly privately owned. And you would see, like, a pall of black smoke over the whole city, nonstop, every day of the week, of just the garbage being burned. And all that garbage that really dominated the whole city line, everywhere you looked, was the smokestacks of the incinerators, right down, and not even in the city, go down the coast, along the Jersey Shore, everywhere. Anywhere they could put an incinerator. They were small. They were inefficient. They only burned a little stuff. You needed a lot of them. And they would bring the garbage by barge to all these incinerators and burn and burn and burn and burn and take the ash and throw it into the holes in the ground inside the city limits. And so incineration is like a smelter. It's like a mini smelter. It actually smelts the metal that's in the garbage down. And that wasn't a big problem in the 1800s because 90% of the garbage, if not more, was organic matter. It was sort of easy to get rid of. I mean, incineration wasn't that bad of an idea when it was just all organic matter. But by the 20s and 30s and 40s, it's all like plastic and stuff like metal and all kinds of weird things. And they're burning and burning more of it. And of course, you have to add this in because all the books going back to the early 20th century, every book says there was no business more corrupt and more rife with city corruption than the incinerator and garbage business in New York. It was absolutely corrupt. And the politicians, the Tammany Hall controlled Staten Island, and they were totally, they were constantly under corruption. And there was so many companies that wanted to sell the city incinerators, and they were constantly bribing and under the table and all kinds of things going on. It was so criminal that it's beyond even, you just consider it a criminal enterprise. And so this criminal enterprise of burning garbage and dumping into holes in the ground all throughout the city went on for decades and years, and it was totally embraced by the Parks Commissioner, Robert Moses, who then used all that ash among garbage from everywhere. And that's just some of the garbage. And all those smelted metals, who knows what was in that garbage, is dumped into Great Kills Park to make, and many other places in New York City, to create the landfill for the park. All right, so at first, they said it was these radium needles that were used for cancer. But then, as they studied it, they said, no, there's radiation that's diffuse through all the dirt and soil of the park. This is not just points of radiation where these little objects were thrown away by crooked hospitals and crooked, you know, medical waste carters, which is very probable, if not possible. But there was other sources. There must have been other things besides those radium cancer points, which the police immediately in the city latched onto as the cause of it. We have all that dirt and all that waste from the incinerators. Okay, good. That too. Well, I started an investigation because I started to think, you know, radium is part of the nuclear bomb production. You need it to make nuclear bombs in the early days. Today, not so much, but in the early days, you needed it. So I began with the theory that the radium was the legacy of nuclear weapons production, coupled with this cavalier attitude towards the odorless, tasteless, and invisible threat posed by radioactivity. And in fact, then Representative Michael Grimm backed me up. He said, the last thing I want is to have anyone or their children get sick or hurt because of this contamination. And, of course, the EPA admits that children are more susceptible than adults to radiation because they're still growing, their cells are still rapidly dividing. So I went to Dr. Marvin Resnikoff, a spokesperson for Radioactive Waste Management Associates, which cleans up radioactive waste dumps, and he said that walking through Great Kills Park is like being exposed to an X-ray machine you can't turn off. He added that children playing on the site could get material on their hands, wipe their faces, causing incidental ingestion of radium. And its biggest problem with radium for children is leukemia. So the government measurements probably underestimate the actual radiation in the Great Kills. He said one foot of dirt can shield up to 98% of gamma radiation given off by the radium, adding that there could be significant levels of radium buried under the soil. Reznikov said the diffuse nature of the contamination in the park indicates a lot of the contamination may be uranium ore left over from the Manhattan Project days. So in 1939, as I read the letter,
the Manhattan Project being the project that created the atom bomb.
Right, the Manhattan Project. And it was based in Manhattan Engineering District, what was called the Manhattan Engineering District of the Army Corps of Engineers. And its headquarters was in Manhattan. And it turns out New York State and New York City was the site of a lot of development. To give you some idea, and I know we're running out of time, but to give you some idea, when I was doing this research, I was chatting about it with a friend of mine who turns out I had no idea, was a chemist. And he worked at a straight job, his regular day job, was doing assays of ores that people would send this company work for from all over the world. And he would assay these ores to see how much of the element they were looking for was in the ore and then be able to quote a price on what the ore would cost to the buyer. And that's a regular job. A lot of people do that job. But his company had been active during the Manhattan Project and after, and they had been working with the Kerr-McGee Corporation, which mined uranium at the time, and was involved in actually assaying uranium ore to see how much uranium was in it. He said, of course, it was a Pakistani or Filipino guy who was doing the assays of radiation. I really felt sorry for him, you know, because a lot of people who did that work died or got cancer later on for it. It's very dangerous work. They usually give it to immigrants, smart immigrants who don't know any better, get that job. It's the only job they can get. And all through it, going back to even the world, you know, back to World War II, that was what happened. They had no place to put the waste. I mean, there's no place to put radioactive waste. So for years and years and years, they kept it in barrels on the roof of the building in Tribeca in Lower Manhattan until it was started to actually, and they poured it in the drain and went into the sewer. And one day, somebody from the city EPA knocked on the door and said, we traced radiation from the sewer, you know, from the sewage treatment plant all the way back through the sewer to this building. And they traced it to the roof. And they found it there. They found it stored on the roof. And that's in Tribeca, and that was maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And then the president of the company and my friend had to supervise a big cleanup. It cost them a fortune. The fine was a fortune. It was, you know, really was a big pain in the neck for the company. But he found out they had actually a table in the company that they didn't know how to throw it out. It had been, when the company was working on the Manhattan Project at another location on Pearl Street in Manhattan, they had contaminated a table, and there's no place to throw out the table, so the table is still in the building, only what they did was they drew a yellow line around the radioactive area and told people who work on the table, don't go past that yellow line. And it's still in the building, and they still use the table. And there's no place to throw it out. It costs a fortune. I mean, like $100,000 to throw out a table, right? So they just keep working there and put a warning sign, like, don't go on this part of the table. And that's actually from the Manhattan Project, that table. That was somebody spilled something on it years before. During the 40s. So where did this uranium come from? Well, all the radium in the world has to come from somewhere. And we know that it's 1/10 of a gram per ton of uranium ore. So what uranium ore was being dug up to create the radium that's now in Great Kills Park? There's only one or two places in the world it could come from. All right. So as I read in that letter, in 1939, the United States, convinced it was in a race with Germany for the bomb, purchased all the uranium it could find. The Belgian owners of the ore coveted the phenomenally valuable radium that existed side by side with the uranium. When the price of radium collapsed a few years later, as better and safer sources of radioactivity were developed, the excess and unneeded radium would end up in public waste stream. And a lot of other places, you wouldn't believe the story, some places kids found it in their old schools. They used to use it for all kinds of weird things, like getting rid of tonsils. They used to get rid of tonsils of people older than me by sticking a radioactive wand in their throat in the nurse's office in the school. And the schools actually had radium in the school nurse's office. And they used it. They used X-rays to measure your feet for shoes and shoe stores. It was everywhere. People really had a ridiculous idea of it. And sometimes this stuff would be lost, and some kids playing with a Geiger counter. That's why the police don't want to set up Geiger counters. The kid's playing with a Geiger counter, and he says, "What's behind this wall?" And him and his buddy bust open the wall in the school, and they find, "What's this little pin that's so hot on the radio Geiger counter?" Right? And that's this type of thing really does happen. There was another guy, a family, that was doing it. The professor was making radium for the U.S. Radium Company in his basement in Philadelphia. And it's the only private residence that's on the Superfund list in the whole United States. He was just dumping it in into the basement of his house in Philadelphia, and he got to make money, a guy from some European country. So that crazy people were doing crazy stuff. So Belgian owners of the ore coveted the phenomenally valuable radium. That's why they were doing these things. And that existed side by side with the uranium. When the price of radium collapsed, okay, so more radioactive hotspots were reported in Great Kills later in 2007. And then they found out the soil was totally polluted. And then in 2009, after 5 years, finally they closed the park, right? And acted like, oh, we're trying to help you. Like, why did it take you so many years to try and help us? So my investigation discovered that Radium Chemical, which was the company that made the radium that those women, those poor women, licked the brushes and got cancer and died and got no money in return for their suffering, and their undark paint, right? And I told you that part of the story. So the owners of these companies basically escaped liability by morphing into new companies under different names and slightly different boards of directors. Still, the ownership of the radium always seemed to trace back to Joseph A. Kelly Sr. His interlocking network of radium paint companies would become one of the largest World War II government contractors by supplying luminescent dials for fighter planes and bombers, and he would also quietly become a major supplier of radium and other rare elements used in the Manhattan Project. And this is interesting. This radium business was long over when the cleanup bill came due. In 1983, and this is just one of many stories, we don't have time for them all. In 1983, Kelly's son, Joseph Jr., agreed to remove 140 grams of radium. That 140 curies, a gram of radium is a curie of radiation. One curie of radiation is equal to 3 tons of radium ore. So 140 grams is like a warehouse stored floor to ceiling with uranium ore. 1 gram is like 3 tons of uranium. It's like your whole living room was filled with uranium ore, right? From one little bit of dust on your hand, right? The massive cleanup in this quiet industrial corner of the city would cost New York City State at least $6 million. That was in 83 money. But Kelly was only required to pay $500,000 in personal liability. Now, this is his son. This is Kelly Jr., right, his son. His dad was very sick and, of course, died of cancer. Kelly had made other agreements regarding heavily polluted sites, similar agreements. The company also owned in Georgia and Illinois, which ultimately ended up stiffing those states with the cost of the cleanup. In Queens, that cleanup apparently extended to the city sewer system, although it's not exactly known exactly what Radium Chemical was doing at that address. Let me say that in quotes. That was from Maurice D. Hinchley, the assemblyman in New York who investigated this at the time. Although it's not known exactly what Radium Chemical was doing at this address. Right, to this day, it would appear that radium particles were washed down through the plumbing system, just like happened in that other company in Tribeca. 1 gram of radium-226, all right, I just told you, it's like a spot of salt equal to a room full of radium ore, uranium ore. So, and then there was other sites. I found a site, a radium chemical operated a site at East 44th Street, now a luxury high-rise. New York Times reported in 1988 there have been as many as 13 radium processing facilities. There's one here on 23rd Street on the east side as well. Safety considerations were almost unknown during the war effort. According to Manhattan Project troubleshooter George A. Cohen, his radiation monitor went berserk on a 1943 trip to the Radium Chemical Company offices in a big building on 6th Avenue. That is Rockefeller Center, not 30 Rock, the one next to it. All right. In his memoirs, so the Radium Chemical had an office there and actually had a laboratory in Rockefeller Center. In his memoirs, Cohen wrote that workplace conditions that would be illegal today were commonplace. I checked out the primitive chemical hood I was directed to use to make the radium beryllium neutron source. They needed neutron sources in order to do experiments to make the atom bomb. And the only way, neutrons aren't easy to make now, but back then it was very rare to be able to create neutron flow to experiment with. And the only way they really had to do it was to mix radium and beryllium, both unbelievably toxic, dangerous chemicals.
I'm getting a sense that with this dumping, it isn't too much of an exaggeration to say that still today, many people living in high rises and going to work in office buildings in Manhattan, these buildings are actually contaminated. And,
well, underneath them,
they're sitting
in
on
the
top
ground
of them.
Underneath them. Probably the people in the buildings have nothing to fear, but it's all over. We don't have enough time in 3 shows to tell you all the stories. there was a place in Queens where they had a piece of thorium the size of a golf ball that sent a 10-ton piece of machinery three stories through the floor of the building. It threw it like a toy. A piece of literally the size of a golf ball exploded without warning in the lab when they were doing secret research. And then today, you could drive by it every day. It's on the exit ramp in Queens of the Whitestone Bridge, of the Throgs Neck Bridge, and there's a housing project there. And they ask the people, they don't know. They know. They say they don't care.
What I want to do, because you're about what, one-third the way there?
Probably. I was going to finish up this part of it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Right, real quick. So, as he said, I went to the roof of the building, Rockefeller Center, on the roof of the building, where air from the hood was released, and was appalled to find that the roof was unacceptably radioactive. Radium chemical may not be alone in carrying the blame for great kills. Throughout the 20th century, radium chemical had one major competitor, International Rare Metals Refinery, also known as the Canadian Radium and Uranium Company Corporation, located in Mount Kisco, New York. Boris Prejil, an agent for International Rare Metals Refinery, negotiated a deal with the company that the company would sell its uranium to the Manhattan Project for its bomb and keep this radium to sell. In 1939, a barge from Africa arrived at the warehouse Prejil administered under the Bayonne Bridge near the colonial-era town of Port Wash, Richmond, on Staten Island. The barge was loaded with 1,200 tons of high-grade uranium ore packed in burlap sacks containing the uranium that would fuel the atom bomb. The site of the warehouse remains radioactive to this day. In the U.S., the uranium was fed into the massive nationwide bomb-making complex. Some was used as fuel to fuel the great Hanford reactors, making plutonium on the Columbia River. That's how I found out about this story, because I started out talking about Hanford, and I wanted to find out where the uranium came from, and it opened up this whole story. And some went to Oak Ridge for enrichment. So they had a plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb. The bomb project was soon to be located in every corner of the country, so the problem is everywhere. Increasingly, radioactive dregs of the ore, as it was further and further processed, would eventually return to New York City for radium extraction at Mount Kisco. Polonium, another strategic radioactive element, would also be extracted as part of payment for the uranium ore. All right, so in 1957, the company was targeted in New York State's first prosecution for exposing employees to excessive radiation. The head of their company died. The head of the laboratory of the company died at the age of 37 from leukemia. But a judge suspended the fine. No fine. Waste from the demolition, because it was legal at the time. Waste from the demolition of the factory was reportedly hauled to Croton, New York, where a federal judge said unrestricted dumping had turned the landfill into an environmental time bomb. All right, and it's still radioactive out there. So, to give you some idea, I wanted to add that this is an interesting connection. The best, the strongest uranium in the world, most pure uranium ore in the world, comes from Katanga in the southern part of the Congo. And the company was owned by the Belgian government. It was called the Belgian Congo at the time. And the Belgian government actually tried to keep the uranium, and it was only discovered they were hiding it in New York. And when they were trying to export it from New York, some people who worked for Standard Oil Company discovered the paperwork and turned them into the government. And the government forced them to make the deal where they would trade them the uranium for the radium. Then the U.S. Army sent troops that reopened the mine, which had been closed, is the Sinkoblwe mine in Katanga, and they start putting the local people to work mining the uranium ore. And the head of the union discovered that they were making, 50 centimes a day less than the white workers. So he went to the head of the company and tried to redress the wages. And when he went into the meeting, the head of the company pulled out a pistol and shot him dead in his office. And the painting of that incident is considered the most important and the most revered national painting that launched the independence movement of the Congo.
Well, we'll have to stop here for today. It's a lot to digest, and I know you haven't told us even the full breadth of it. So
nobody knows.
Means that we will follow this fairly soon. We just have to coordinate schedules.
Sure.
But it is quite a story, a very different kind of New York story that links us literally through these molecules of radioactive materials.
And they are so secretive. They won't give me anything. I got to draw everything out by hook or by crook, like pulling teeth. And I would like to know. New York City is the only place where the Homeland Security has refused, and the U.S. military and the nuclear weapons complex of America, which is behind all of this, has refused to turn over the detailed results of the radiation flyover. Other cities, Washington, Baltimore, and others, Boston, have released this information. You can see every hot spot in those cities, even in Washington. But New York, they absolutely refuse to release it. And I have several Freedom of Information Acts out, and they just totally ignore me.
I thank you for being with us today, Paul. As I said, we'll talk and we'll figure out how we proceed so that you have ample space and time to tell this story.
Yes.
Incredible, mind-blowing story. So thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Yatrice. Take care.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Ring of Fire Radio. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And I really urge you to listen to this program again before the next installment. It is really terrifying. And few people know what is actually happening to them every day of their lives and being exposed to these dangers every single day in a happening city, right? You never think that these are the kinds of things that you have to worry about or that the government absolutely refuses to tell you. So thanks for people like Paul DiRienzo who take it upon themselves to try and find the truth. Thanks for listening, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.